Sometimes the fun begins when the paved road ends. Chevy Silverado 2500 HD is made to work hard and play hard on the road or off. Go to ChevyDriveChicago.com for details and experience life in HD.
There's a silence in the city. There's a silence in the suburb. It's all relative. How much is silence? How much is noise? And then, of course, there's that silent thunk of a hammer on a body. I keep saying it, but I'm wondering if I should start shouting it or screaming it. It's not the shouting or the screaming that tells you the story. It's the silence that tells you the story. Of course, silence is relative. When a hammer hits a human being, it's relatively silent. But hammers were in the hands of the fascist left Antifa group in Portland. I guess that's the socialist paradise. And they rained those hammer, at least one or maybe more, on the bodies of the Proud Boys, who are apparently the thugs of the right. And sooner or later, after the hammers, will come the guns. Because that's what happens. You bring hammers out, the next guy brings a gun. And then they're going to be silent, at least for a while. Somebody's going to be on the ground and it'll be silent. But that's just some of the silence. The silence I want to talk about today is another kind. And it's really silent. Remember collusion? Remember Russia and collusion? And Putin and President Trump being depicted as a traitor, as treasonous, by John Brennan, the former director of the CIA, on MSNBC, again and again and again. It was Trump, Russia, Russia, Trump, 24/7, on all the cable networks, in the papers, in punditry. And everyone was so sure that it was Trump was a stooge of the Russians. I guess it made it easier to think that way after they lost their election in 2016. They had to have an excuse, and that was the excuse. Now, of course, they've switched. They've switched to racism. Now everyone's a racist. And racism 24/7. The New York Times and other media are going to focus exclusively on race for the next, I don't know how many months until the election. I wonder how long we can take it. But what happened? Why is the Trump-Russia thing no longer a story? Why aren't they screaming about collusion? Because another hammer is going to fall. And that hammer is by the Justice Department. And Michael Horowitz, the Inspector General of the FBI. And that hammer's coming. You can see it in the book, Ball of Collusion, by Andrew McCarthy. And you can read it in some media, including Real Clear Investigations. The hammer is coming. And Lindsey Graham the other day said it on national television. Talked about the investigation coming and how hurtful it will be to some people. And how the American public needs to know that perhaps the collusion wasn't between Trump and Russia, but more likely the collusion was a Chicago-way takedown between the Obama administration, perhaps even President Obama himself, and his minions working feverishly as part of an insurance policy. We'll talk about all this with Tom Bevin, of Real Clear Politics, the co-founder of Real Clear Politics and publisher. And with my friend and co-host, well, they're both my friends, and my friend and co-host, Jeff Carlin. Jeff Carlin of WGN Radio, the executive producer of The Rokan Show with Anna DeVellantis. And I'm John Cass, husband, father, columnist of the Chicago Tribune, member of its editorial board. And where are you? You're listening to the sound of silence, and you're wondering, like me, why are they so silent? For now, you're on the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.
Look, the Chicago Way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man.
Hello.
there was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand, defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso in a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
Well, Jeff Carlin, an amazing thing happened over the weekend. I got a call from two police officers who don't want to be identified. They never do. And I bought them breakfast in Bridgeport, and I paid them for the objects that they brought to me. And these objects are large, round, yellowy, and orange, and they come from Tom Ringhausen of Ringhausen Orchards in Hardin, Illinois, devastated by floods. They went down there. They called me from Tom Hardin's place. They were looking for it, but it was washed out.
Yeah.
And they were saying, where's the plate? It's washed out. Where is it? There was a church washed out. There were a lot of devastation from the flood.
A lot of trouble down there.
And then they were driving by a bar, and they saw peaches outside. And they went in, and they said, do you know this guy, Tom Ringhausen? And they said, sure, he's over here drinking. And he was out back drinking and, I guess, you know, barbecuing or something. And he came out, and then they called me, and we made a deal. So for $35, I got a half a bushel of peaches, and I'm bringing some to the editorial board, even though, you know, I don't know if they'll accept, you know, the conservative gift. But but either way, I offer it in good spirit.
They're organic, and, right?
And I offer one to you.
I know, I'm holding it in my hand. So I've got it in my left hand, my offhand, so I can really feel the weight of it. And it is something. I'd say if I were, I was just re-upping all my flowers and things in my pantry at home for my, you know, because the weather's turning and it's going to be baking season soon enough. And this, I'd say probably about a 2-3 pound bag of flour here in my hand, essentially, but it's a peach.
It's about 2.5 pounds of peaches easy.
Yeah.
And it's about as big as a softball, 16 inch.
Oh,
maybe,
yeah.
Just maybe a 14 inch.
Yeah, probably a 14.
We both have big hands, and your hand, and it fills your hand. Man.
It looks big in my hand, and that's saying much.
So now, Jeff, do you have any napkins with you?
I brought a stack, which I thought was a large stack, but now that I'm feeling the weight of it, it may not be enough.
Well, he's going to let you know, there, we talked about silence before, but let's hear the sound of Jeff eating a peach. Jeff, eat a peach. Jeff,
you know,
Beck.
This is like the bane of my existence, recorded sound of eating, but I'm going to do it just because this is worth doing. As juice comes pouring down my chin.
He did have, he put a little bowl. I don't know where WGN has a perfect peach eating bowl.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't have to do the lean, you know, like when you eat a Italian beef and you got to lean forward so you don't get it on the shelf, which right. is where I get all my steak. Betty's like, oh, there goes it. Go back to Orvis. You got another polo shirt ruined. But that thing is dripping juice, God, man.
I just took one bite and I'm eating it over a bowl. And there's like quarter of an ounce of juice already in the bowl. No exaggeration, which is amazing.
Now, those are white peaches, and he still has some. And if you get go down there, you don't have to bring me any. But I'm telling you, people, there's some things in Illinois still worth having for all of those of you who are leaving the state.
Yeah.
Remember this. There's peaches. And these peaches, I'm sorry, Michigan. I love you. Love you, Michigan. But you know what? Does Michigan have Tlaib? Is that the? Is she from there?
I believe, yes.
Yeah, yeah. But outside of that, their peaches are pretty good.
Their peaches are good. Their cherries are good. They do.
But there's nothing like
Lake Perch.
There's nothing like those Calhoun County peaches. I mean it.
Yeah.
And they're so good and so juicy. That's why they can't bring. You can't commercially send them up here.
Yeah, that thing is fantastic. I look forward to finishing the rest of that. But speaking of leaving town, John and I both have a couple of things that strike home in that record. My brother has fled the state with his family, his three kids and wife. They've fled to South Carolina.
Illinois Exodus.
Yeah, Illinois Exodus. I mean, and their biggest reasoning behind it is that the cost of living here is so expensive. And they didn't live in the city proper. I mean, they lived out, you know, 35 miles out, northwest suburbs. But the cost of living is just crushing them. And they can get much more for what they have or what they want in South Carolina.
It looks like your brother made his decision based on economics. And you buy a house and it costs you $300,000, say. Yeah. Okay? And if you're paying $20,000 in taxes every year, then basically that's, you know, $200,000 every 10 years. Yeah. So where's the equity of your home? It's gone. All you're doing is renting that home from the government so they can...
Renting to pay for public unions.
Public union. That's what it is. It's the public unions. It's the superintendents of school. And disclaimer, my wife and son are both teachers, and I revere and respect teachers, but the economic reality of it is that if you live in a one-party state like Illinois is a Democratic, blue Democratic state, there's no Republican Party, and the only Republican Party there is are facilitators of the Democratic bosses, and that's why they cut all these deals. You know, that's why we have good friends of ours who are Republicans who are saying that guys like the indicted Tom Cullerton, state senator, is a good guy. One of our friends that we've had on this show say that.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry, good guy, indicted? Well, okay, but then who pays?
Right.
You know who pays? People like your brother, and they're tired of it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And no disparagement to the working class who need unions and use unions to make sure that they, you know, have what they need. I'm talking about the rank and file. The people
there's rank and file. It's a system.
But at the same time, you hit on it. I mean, the idea that it's a one-party system that rules everything. So one party is getting benefit, the other party's not. But it's not about really even about party at that point. You might as well live in a fascist state because... You know, if you're connected to the party, then you get the good bread. If you're not connected to the party, you get the crappy bread.
It's almost like the Soviet Union, right? Yeah. In the sense that you have the Central Committee.
Exactly.
Mike Madigan's the head of it. The fat boy with the sash who holds news conferences and cuts ribbons is the governor. And I don't really think they're getting along too well. Just to give you in on one thing. But that thing is a disaster, and it's going to happen. And without the pushback, without a Republican Party pushback, guess this is what you have.
Yeah.
And I don't want to hurt any union people.
Right.
Absolutely. But I see all these. I see a brain drain of smart young people, like those your three nieces and nephews that are leaving.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're leaving, so they won't grow up here, and they won't produce here.
Yeah, no taxes collected from them ever, and it's completely just destroying that sense of, you know, that why would I want to stay here? Why would you want to be here? I get it. I totally get it, and it's a tough thing to do. But speaking of moving on and moving out, John, a little bit of development in your family circle?
Oh, yeah, the boys moved out.
Ah, jeez.
Yeah, apartment. I got an apartment that's good, and cooked for him yesterday. You know, they've been in and out of the house. Betty's all with that HGTV thing I've been telling you about. It's driving me crazy. But here's what happened. The boys left, and okay, boys, bye, and they took off. And then we're getting ready for bed, and Zeus comes upstairs looking for them.
No.
And then he just sat with us, and he was, like, kind of whimpering, like he knew they were gone, you know?
Aww.
And we'll see how he's doing. You know, he's too old to catch rabbits. Now he's, like, 10 years old, so he can't catch the rabbits anymore. He's chasing them. But, we'll see. You know, maybe they'll come take him for a day or two, you know? And they're still in town. I mean, they're not out of town.
Yeah, but still leaving the house.
It's big. But that's okay. That's part of life, right? Get out. Fly, little bird. Fly. Exactly. Fly out of the nest. And I like that. When I was 19, I mean, they're like older than I was when I was 19. Yeah. I was in Africa, South America, the Virgin Islands. I was in Georgetown, Guyana. I was in Lagos, Nigeria, by myself, working on a ship. Thought that would be my life, and it's not. So you got to just fly. People talking without speaking. People hearing without listening. People writing songs and voices never shared. And no one dared disturb the sound of silence. And now, as promised, joining us to talk about the silence and the loudness of certain things is Tom Bevan, my friend, co-founder and publisher of Real Clear Politics. If you go to any website besides the ChicagoTribune.com, you have to go to Real Clear Politics, Real Clear Investigations. I've been reading all about Trump, Russia, and what happened with the Department of Justice and that the hammer that's going to fall there on certain actors. And then here's a tweet by Tom Bevan. I thought we'd start the discussion. Here's Tom Bevan. Quote, at Tom Bevan is how you find
RCP, right?
At Tom Bevan RCP, yeah. While staying in Venezuela, we didn't see a single homeless person, unquote, says someone who is in charge of teaching children in Chicago. What a total clown show. When I saw the Chicago Teachers Union send a delegation to Venezuela, and Tom, you saw it too, did you wonder what they were going to eat? Like what zoo animals they would eat for lunch in Venezuela? And you didn't see anybody homeless or suffering?
This is one of those stories. It's on the front page of the Chicago Tribune's website, but I'm sure they've plagiarized it from The Onion, right? I'm sure this is a parody that four teachers decide to go on a trip to Venezuela so that they can see. And by the way, the second part of that quote was, in America, we're the richest nation on earth, and we got homeless people all over the place. So, you know, by implication, like, why aren't we more like Venezuela? Venezuela's great. There's no homeless here. I mean, it's insane. And yet, and the fact that these people are the people who are in charge, you know, we drop our kids off every day so that them, and I'm not disparaging all teachers, but you certainly have folks like this who you just wonder, oh my gosh, these are the folks that are in charge of teaching our children how to learn and navigate the world. And it's frightening. Frightening.
Well, it's almost like they might have a political agenda with which to inculcate the young minds of America.
You think? No, it's crazy. It's just craziness.
Seriously, unless they went down there with like bushels of bread and were trying to feed people and do some humanitarian thing, what's the point? What are they trying to learn here? What are they learning? Is it a charitable thing? It doesn't make any sense.
No, right? They want to copy Venezuela's education system and see what the best practices are or something and bring them back to Chicago. I mean, it's craziness. And, you know, we pick on these folks in particular because they're from Chicago. But, I mean, you see these stories. I mean, I go to the front pages of all these newspapers all across the country every single day. And every day you'll run into a story or two like this from, you know, cities around the country that are doing just crazy stuff. You read these crazy stories. And it's just, unfortunately, it's the world we live in.
Well, the story quotes the teachers union boss, Jesse Sharkey. He apparently appeared on WTTW Chicago Tonight, and he was asked about some controversy, unquote, surrounding the excursion. And Sharkey, who I think is the heir of Carnival Cruise Lines or the other one, is a multi-million dollar.
One of those. Yeah,
you know, nothing like a rich communist or socialist to tell you what to do. And he said, quote, members go to all kinds of places in the summer. This was neither an official trip nor something that was funded by the union. This is a group of people who are members of CTU who decided to go to Venezuela. So in other words, what is it? Do you support it, Mr. Sharkey, or not? I didn't really get the sense of him being held to account.
Well, one of them is apparently an executive board member. So
So, Tom, now that we've dispatched the Chicago Teachers Union, and again, I'm the father of a union member, teacher, and I can't even believe I said that, and the husband of one, and our dinner table conversations are quite lively.
I bet.
Right? We're kind of like, we have a line of demarcation.
Did Betty ever go to Venezuela to...
to teach dance to the starving children? No, she did not. She has not yet, and I don't think she would.
Because send your son off to Cuba to see what's cooking down there?
I don't think so. But again, what's cooking in Venezuela? They've already eaten all the zoo animals.
Yeah,
and there's nothing
lions
left.
And tigers and bears. Oh my!
You know, the toilet paper's gone. Then they ate the tapirs.
You should actually go down there, John, and show them how to cook meat the right way.
There you go. Beer can
it's
peacock?
A humanitarian mission.
What's left to eat there?
Peacock. They have to take left some, peacock for that.
Shortstops? Broiled shortstops? I don't know. I don't think so.
You have to take a container of beef down there and show them how to barbecue it and grill it.
Or Spam. Show them how to fry it.
There you go.
There you go. So, Tom, what's on your mind these days in politics?
Well, listen,
in the world?
I assumed that you want to be back on the podcast so I could wreck your stuff over Blagojevich, but we can talk
okay,
about whatever
you
want.
Okay,
Fredo. Oh, jeez. Oh, jeez.
He put out a tweet, Cass, I'm going to, quoting Fredo Cuomo, going to wreck your bleep. Yeah. I didn't know how to respond to this.
This is a family podcast. Can we not say that?
Yeah, but I liked it. I don't know. I don't like Twitter in that too many lefties there. And also, do you like something like that? I don't know if you're supposed to. Are you accused of a sin if you like something?
No, liking it is not necessarily endorsing. You're just, you're enjoying the engagement.
Correct. People
all right,
like
so.
Stuff. I mean, you know what? Andrew Breitbart used to, and there are other people who do this, is when someone posts something particularly vile and nasty about them, they will like it so that all their followers can see it.
Ooh,
Which is, I don't know. I'm not.
That is that. A strategery as a.
Yeah.
So I can do that with all these lefties who are screaming at me that I don't understand the bail
correct.
Bond system.
Yes. You can retweet it or like it, and then all your followers will see it. And then the way that works is theoretically, your supporters will attack that person and say, what a fool and idiot and rube they are, or whatever. That's kind of how Twitter operates. It's just directing the outrage mob in one direction or another.
Well, I'm safe sitting on my deck watching Rick and Morty marathons and having a fine Maduro cigar. Okay,
exactly.
Good.
Exactly.
And speaking of reacting to things on Twitter, I mean, that's where kind of the Blago stuff all started, at least locally. It was your colleague, Rick Pearson, tweeting something about it, and then late at night, and of course it blew up across the internet, and oh my God, because outside of Chicago, I don't think anybody cared. It seemed like it hit the airways, people were picking up on this.
Well, when Trump addressed it, that's when people became sort of national news, when Trump said he was thinking about commuting his sentence. I mean, that's...
Yeah, but I mean, the flight back, like that, like there was a bit of a lag from when that, and I saw it first, that night, the Pearson tweet. And then there was a good, 12-hour lag before it even really kind of percolated into outside of Chicago. I mean, Chicago jumped on it. But then the idea that this thing happened. But then the rift grew out of it between Dear Casso and Dear Tom.
Look, I think this guy, and I'm no fan of Blago. I'm not, don't want to defend him or his actions in any way. He was a thug and just kind of a crass political operator. But, I mean, he's he spent 7 years in prison already, and which is, a decent amount of time. And I thought 15 years was an excessive sentence for this guy who basically, John, you'll say he tried to shake down like a, children's hospital, but I mean, he talked about how he was going to do this thing. He was caught on tape saying he's effing golden and he's got this thing and but in terms of actually what he actually did, I think politicians around the country have been, doing this kind of thing for a long, long time. This is, backroom horse trading deals and all that kind of stuff. And yes, some of them get caught, and when they do, they should be punished. But I thought just the punishment was excessive, and the guy spent 7 years in jail. He's got kids that he hasn't seen, and it's kind of like, you know, enough already.
My thumb is being revolved around by my index finger, and I'm playing a tiny violin.
Tiny violin? Why do you have no mercy for this guy? Why do you think he should spend 15 years of his life in prison for talking about a Senate seat that he thought he had control of?
Think of it this way. If he had succeeded, and really the story, we talked about it last week with one of your friends, Charles Lipson. If the counterfactual, if the Chicago Tribune hadn't broken the story that Blago's guy, John Wyma, was wearing being wired up, his office wired up, then we would have had the mysterious Indian businessmen continuing their quest to purchase a Senate seat for Jesse Jackson Jr. And then he becomes senator. And then where do we go? I find this to be, I find the constitutional issue.
But none of that ever happened.
Right. But it, was going to happen.
And but it didn't.
Yes.
This is like a Tom Cruise Minority Report, like pre-crime. You know, we can't like punish someone for something that may happen in the future or may have happened in the future. He was found out. He was held accountable. He was punished.
There's one other aspect. We won't agree on this, but there's one other aspect on which we will, perhaps, and that is not really covered much. President Trump does not like Jim Comey. We know that. Jim Comey was not the boss of the FBI at the time of the takedown, but he was involved with justice. And the U.S. attorney that put Blago in prison is none other than Comey's buddy and lawyer now. And he'll need a lawyer, apparently. And that's Patrick Fitzgerald. So I just got a sense that Trump was doing this also to gig Mr. Fitzgerald as well.
Well, he may be, but I mean, set that aside and just on the merits of it, is 7 years enough for the crime that Blagojevich committed or not? That's my point. And, you know, look, Patrick Fitzgerald, I think we have a difference of opinion about him. I mean, his involvement in the Scooter Libby case, the way that he zealously prosecuted. And you talk about prosecutorial discretion, and you talk about what's going on in the Justice Department now. And Patrick Fitzgerald, when you go back and look at the way that he handled the Scooter Libby prosecution, knowing that Scooter Libby was not involved in that, and that it was actually Richard Armitage who had named Valerie Plame and all that, and yet continued to pursue him, that was a travesty. I mean, this guy was out of control. And, you know, I feel like there's a similar level of overzealousness and abuse of prosecutorial power when it comes to Rob Blagojevich. Again, not saying he shouldn't be held accountable for you know, doing what he did and all that. But, you know, for me personally, I think 7 years is he has paid his debt to society. And I see no problem with Trump commuting his sentence.
My nephew Alex, he just turned 26 today. I said, Alex, you know, I called him for his birthday, and I said, it's just too bad you're not 4 years older, because I could have given you a U.S. Senate seat for your birthday. Oh. I mean, I've got this thing, and it's fucking golden.
Well, one thing we may see is Patrick Fitzgerald being held to account. I mean, he's representing Comey, and if I'm reading Real Clear Politics Investigations carefully, and I hope I am, it seems like the hammer is about to fall on certain people that are represented by Mr. Fitzgerald. What do you make of it?
Yeah, I mean, look, we've been doing a lot of reporting on the Mueller report and the Mueller investigation. You just had Lindsey Graham on Fox News, Fox Business, Sunday Morning Futures with Maria Bartiromo yesterday talking about this IG report that's going to come out. And he said it's going to be ugly and it's going to be brutal for the Department of Justice. their abuse. I think we're going to learn, you know, and then you've got what John Durham's doing, his investigation for Attorney General Barr. I think there are a lot of folks who are in legal jeopardy here. James Comey is certainly among them, even though, you know, they said they're not going to prosecute Comey for his leaks. There could be other issues where he is, could be in some legal jeopardy. And some of these other folks, I mean, the more we're learning about this, the more we're finding out that it was a really sort of tangled web that involved a lot of folks in the DOJ and FBI, and all centered around, I mean, this
and CIA.
And CIA. And this idea that Glenn Simpson, who's a former reporter for the Wall Street Journal, who runs Fusion GPS, was at the center of it all, pushing this dossier and this intel, which he had been hired by the Clinton campaign to dig up and got from an overseas intelligence, MI5 British asset, is just remarkable that he was able to manipulate and infect, you know, I guess these folks took it willingly and used it. But it's pretty disturbing, actually, when you look at it. And then we spent 2 years in the media obsessing about this day in and day out. And now you see, and this goes off to a media criticism angle, John, but I mean, this transcript of the New York Times that was leaked, it was Dean Baquet, the editor of the New York Times, had sort of an all hands on deck meeting with his newsroom to talk about the changing of the headline and all of that, and basically said, and the transcript was leaked to Slate Magazine, you can read it, and I did yesterday, and it's just astonishing. I mean, he says, you know, we built our newsroom around covering basically the Russia collusion case for 2 years, and he said we did it better than anyone, and we won 2 Pulitzers, and we should be really proud of that, but you know, our readers really wanted to get Trump. And when Bob Mueller walked off that witness stand and it was clear he wasn't going to get Trump anymore, you know, we had to shift the narrative to a new story. And the new story that we're focused on now is covering a racist president in this day and age and what it's like to be a minority struggling with, you know, a president who uses racism. And then there was a whole discussion about, you know, should we use the term racist? Should we not use the term racist? So a reporter actually asked Dean Baquet this question. Here it is. Listen to this. Hello. This is a staffer from the New York Times. Hello. I have another question about racism. I'm wondering to what extent you think that the fact of racism and white supremacy being sort of the foundation of this country should play in our reporting, just because it feels to me like it should be a starting point, you know? Like these conversations about what is racist, what isn't racist. I just feel like racism isn't everything. It should be considered in our science reporting, our culture reporting, and our national reporting. And so to me, it's less about the individual instances of racism and sort of how we're thinking about racism and white supremacy as the foundation of all the systems in the country. And so that end quote. And so that sort of gives you an idea of not only where the media has been for the last 2 years, and the New York Times sort of sets the trend for all the media coverage still in terms of the Russia coverage, but now how they've shifted the focus to basically viewing everything that they do through the lens of racism. And they just produced this, they call it the 1619 Project, which is this big expose on the founding of, you know, the first slave ship that came across and the legacy of slavery in the United States, which would be fine if they just reported that and tried to inform their audience. But what they said and how they described this project was to, quote unquote, reframe our history, viewing everything currently that's happening through the sort of original sin of slavery in America. And so that's kind of where we are and where we're headed, I think.
Well, you mentioned the reporter's question. Here's Baquet, and I worked with Dean Baquet. Here is his response to that, which really got to me. I mean, I was thunderstruck. But then, of course, I've watched journalism shoot itself in the foot, and now it's basically blown its head off. When he said, Dean Baquet to the reporter, our readers who want Donald Trump to go away suddenly thought, holy, Bob Mueller is not going to do it. And Donald Trump got a little emboldened politically, I think, because, you know, for obvious reasons. And I think the story changed. A lot of the stuff we're talking about started to emerge like 6 or 7 weeks ago. In other words, like you said, Mueller, collusion, Russia, that fell apart. So let's go to race now. It is just, I'm astounded, Tom, that the standards of my business have collapsed so completely.
Yeah, what happened to just reporting the news, as Carl Cannon likes to say, without, quote, fear or favor, right? What happened to just, you know, and the critics will say that, well, the New York Times is a for-profit institution, and they need to sort of cater to the whims of their readers, because if they don't, they'll cease to exist as a business, right? Everyone will, and so their readers are all upper-class white liberals from mainly from New York, but also from around the country and certainly on the East Coast. And they have been, and Dean Becquet mentions this, and their readers have been clamoring for anti-Trump coverage to be, you know, basically the New York Times has had, felt like it has had to become part of the resistance in order to engage its readers. And by the way, that strategy has succeeded. They have had a huge increase in online subscriptions since Trump took office. And so they're caught in this cycle now where they're no longer, you know, quote unquote, the paper of record who's just reporting the news. They are, and this speaks to the issue about the headline, right? Trump urges unity versus racism, and that was somehow unacceptable to Nate Silver and all these liberals, and they got browbeaten into changing their headline. And so that's kind of where, look, I, you know, Dean Becquet is a longtime journalist. He's been in this business for a long time, and I'm sure he's got some of that old school instinct left in him, John. But as the editor of a, you know, big paper, major paper in a major metropolitan area, in fact, the biggest paper, he's under a lot of pressure. And that's just the reality of sort of the news business today. And it's unfortunate because, you know, it'd sure be nice just to get some facts and some objective reporting from the New York Times, you know, on a day-to-day basis, but more and more they seem to be infusing their coverage with opinion and this racial angle and all that stuff. And it may succeed in keeping them afloat in terms of, you know, subscriptions, but it's hurting their credibility, and it's further balkanizing them in sort of the media landscape, I think.
It's not only balkanizing them, it's balkanizing the rest of us.
And, sure. Absolutely.
I want to point out to our listeners that Real Clear Politics ran an excellent piece a while back on the issue of the New York Times and the Washington Post congratulating themselves with their little journalism club and giving themselves Pulitzers over, I think, Mueller and the Mueller investigation.
Right.
That turned out not to hold water, but they still, you know, we won the Pulitzer. Of course you did. You're all part of the same group of morons. And you clap each other on the back. But that piece was just outstanding. And it mentioned, again, Real Clear Politics had it. It was exclusive to them. It mentioned the resistance piece of year of just, you know, 20 around shortly after the time Tom Bevin predicted that Michelle Obama might run for president. There was a piece in the New York Times basically saying that all journalism should be part of the resistance. I was astounded then. We've talked about it a number of times, but you see how it's going. And I don't understand the dynamic, the demographics, because you have the elite on the left, that is the elite, the Manhattan, you know, the New York Times readership, and their allies, what, in the ghetto and a few black-clad anti-fascists. This is the new coalition of the left. This is what the left is about. Economic elites representing the poor that they wouldn't even talk to in a restaurant or even allow them in their restaurants. And this is the politics. It seems to me just disjointed and dangerous.
Well, look, I do think... from a media perspective, the country, you know, we just ran something on Real Clear Politics. Scott Rasmussen did a poll for Cheryl Atkinson and her show Full Measure, talking about the sort of media, and only one in five people trust the news they get from the political news they get from the media these days. One in five. So seven, basically 25%, or yeah, just over one. So it was under, I think it was about 23%. So you get what? 77%, three out of four, basically, who are saying that they don't trust the news that they get from the media. I mean, the media is facing a huge credibility crisis, and it's been exacerbated by Trump and their coverage of Trump and Trump calling them fake news. And so we are now in a situation where, you know, the old media landscape is gone. It's unfortunate. We talk about this all the time, John, because there is, you know, there are plenty of outlets on the right that are, you know, cater to the whatever the opposite of the resistance is, right? That are hardcore right outlets and provide only that perspective. And it makes it hard for the vast majority of folks who are just looking for sort of, my wife is constantly comes to me and is like, you know, what's the deal with this? I you know, I watch this story in the news and is like, is that the real story, or what's, where can I find the real story? What do I have to do? And it's, I think there are a lot of people out there who would just like to have sort of, you know, the spin taken away from both sides and just present the facts without this discussion of, you know, left and right and all of that stuff. But unfortunately, that is harder and harder to find. And I think we're worse off as a country because of it, for sure.
And to John's point earlier, too, the piece about how it's, you know, with the New York Times impacting all of us. And I mean all of us, anybody in media, anybody running a newspaper, anybody who's trying to disseminate quote-unquote news or information, everybody's trying to follow this lead, this idea that, well, you know, you're not going to be able to cater to everybody and make money off of it, so pick a group and just lap it onto them and suck up to them and give them what they want, and you'll be viable in an economic sense. And it's like you said, it destroyed that fourth wall, that fourth piece of state, rather, is just completely gone away.
Well, I mean, just think back to the quote that I read from a staffer at the New York Times, right? That believes that the country is founded on racism, white supremacy, all these institutions and everything. It needs to be the starting point for all their coverage, right? The New York Times is still considered the most prestigious part. I mean, they're getting the best of the best in terms of the journalistic crowd, right? The journalistic students. Just imagine that, you know, that's the mentality that's operating in their newsroom and in, quite frankly, other newsroom. I don't want to disparage the Chicago Tribune. John, you can maybe speak to that. But,
well, I'm a lonely conservative on a sugar cookie floating in the sea of liberal milk, Tom.
Right. So, but in newsrooms across the country, that's the prevailing mentality. And you think there's no diversity of journalism. Journalist folks always talk, well, we need more diversity because we've got, you know, just white folks writing the news. And so we need people of color. We need women. We need Latinos. And it's like, it's all that. And that's all fine, well, and good. Okay. But what they really need is diversity of opinion and thought, because it is such a herd mentality now among these folks that there are no conservatives in these newsrooms. There are no conservatives that are leading papers. Yes, they have some conservative columnists, you know, syndicated columnists on the opinion page like John and others. But in terms of like shaping news coverage, deciding which stories get covered, how they get covered, how they appear on the front page, what pictures are used, all of that, assignment editors, you know, down to the reporters themselves, there aren't any conservatives. They've been sort of run out of the business. And that is, I think, unfortunate.
Or they never got hired.
Or they never got hired, or they've been, you know, there are some, you know, they're clustered in places like the Washington Examiner and, you know, maybe the New Hampshire Union Leader, which has sort of a conservative tilt to its editorial page, you know, but I don't know about the newspaper itself. Wall Street Journal is another place where, you know, the editorial page is still conservative, but the paper itself and the reporting is, you know, further to the left. And I'm not saying, by the way, that these papers should be covering things as, you know, quote unquote conservatively. I'm just saying they should have people in the newsroom who, you know, have a difference of a different viewpoint and would be able to say, hey, you know what, maybe we should cover this story. This, we haven't been given enough attention to this. Or, you know what, maybe in an editor saying, you know what, in this story, instead of quoting three you know, folks from liberal organizations. Why don't we go get a conservative voice to be part of this news story, so it's more even-handed as opposed to one-sided, that kind of stuff. It makes all the difference in the world, and it just doesn't happen anymore. It's unfortunate.
Of course, the silence of media now when it comes to Mueller and the Mueller report that failed, as Dean Baquet explained to us in that piece you referenced, they switched to racism and get louder again. But that's the Mueller report, it was 24/7. I remember, Tom, the New York Times running animated cartoons showing the President Trump and his, they made him a homosexual boyfriend, Vladimir Putin, together blowing kisses at each other, hugging, and all sorts of things like this. And I thought, my God, this has really gone far. And now it's silent. Now it's nothing. They just switch completely to
a
new...
The caravan moves on, and there will be no accountability. In fact, the reporters all patted themselves on the back when the Mueller report came out, saying, see, this just confirms that all of our reporting was really good and accurate and correct, which sort of reinforced the idea that they don't really know what they're talking about and are sort of deluded on the issue.
If you want balance, I suggest everyone go to the Real Clear Politics website. You'll see stories from the right and from the left and from the center. You'll see the Real Clear Politics polling, the Real Clear Politics investigations, science, religion. What you're doing, Tom, is basically creating a news organization of what we talked about months ago, where you're actively seeking to have diversity of opinion and thought on Real Clear Politics, and I congratulate you for that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, we work really hard. And it's, you know, unfortunately for folks these days, you probably do have to read, you know, two articles. You have to read the left opinion and the right opinion and then sort it out yourself, where you, which one you think is not only the better argument, but has, you know, has better facts, and maybe the truth you'll find is somewhere in between, or at least you'll have some perspective on things. Because these days, if you were just to read the New York Times and only the New York Times, or just to watch MSNBC and only MSNBC, you would walk away with a viewpoint of the world that would be at odds with reality often. Just as some folks do who watch Fox all the time and come away thinking, you know, one thing about a story. I mean, that's part of the problem, is we've kind of, in some ways, we live in two separate universes based on our political preferences. And so it is good to always have an understanding of how the other side views the story, even if you don't agree with it. And that way you'll be more well-informed and have a better idea of the different perspectives that are out there. Otherwise, you know, we're kind of walking around with our blinders on.
But Tom Bevin doesn't walk around with those blinders. And I
try not to.
I think, except when it comes to me and my views on certain things. Listen, my friend Tom, thank you so much for being part of the Chicago Way this week. And just thank you for your friendship and kindness. And if you can only give Pat Fitzgerald a break when he's defending Comey's... Well, he'll be defending Comey for the same things that he prosecuted Scooter Libby for. That should be fascinating, I have to say.
I did not do my best Chris Cuomo imitation on the podcast, John. I apologize. It's a civil discussion, which is always great with you. So I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks
so much. You know what? When Tom Bevin was talking, we were talking just a touch about the young journalists. They're coming out of journalism school now as trained as propagandists. It's all about propaganda. They want to move people's opinions. They all, you know, I was happy to be a police reporter and then a political writer and an analyst, but without opinion, or at least, you know, analysis that with least amount of opinion. And now, of course, even everybody in newsrooms all over are pushing their agenda, and it's indicative of where the country is, and it's really not a good thing. For Jeff Carlin and his peaches, and you know what? He ate half that peach during this broadcast, and he'll eat the rest later with Rokan and Anna DeVolantis and tell them all about it. For Tom Bevin, co-founder and president of Real Clear Politics, go to that site. Yes, he does run me on from time to time, and I'm very appreciative of it. And for me, John Cass, hated by the left now, husband, father, nationally syndicated columnist for the Chicago Tribune and member of its editorial board. Remember this. It's the silence that tells you the story, especially now in this time when everything is so loud. It's not what they scream at you. It's what they're not screaming at you. Join us again for another edition of the Chicago Way on WGN+.